the Bay of Pigs, Watergate, Geraldo Rivera doing nearly anything, the swine flu vaccine, George Bush Sr. and Japanese food, or George Bush Jr. and pretzels, hunts for weapons of mass destruction, blunders. When we make them as a nation, sometimes the results hang on like a bad cold. But whether public official or private citizen, you make them.
Yeah, you do.
Blunders are as plentiful as bad air. We misspeak ourselves, neglect to check, overlook the obvious, or just put two and two together wrong. So, on the next Mind's Eye Radio, our writers confess themselves and others in Oops! Or the Tao of Do. Half a league onward, all in the Valley of Death rode the 600. Forward the Light Brigade, charge for the guns, he said. Into the Valley of Death rode the 600. Forward the Light Brigade! Was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldier knew someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. Into the Valley of Death rode the 600. Cannon to the right of them, cannon to the left of them, cannon in front of them volleyed and thundered. Stormed at with shot and shell, boldly they rode and well, into the jaws of death, into the mouth of hell rode the 600. Flashed all their sabers bare, flashed as they turned in air, sabering the gunners there, charging an army while all the world wondered. Plunged in the battery smoke, right through the line they broke. Cossack and Russian reeled from the saber stroke, shattered and sundered, then they rode back, but not the 600. Cannon to the right of them, cannon to the left of them, cannon behind them volleyed and thundered. Stormed at with shot and shell, while horse and hero fell. That they had fought so well, came through the jaws of death, back from the mouth of hell, all that was left of them, left of the 600. When can their glory fade? Oh, the wild charge they made, all the world wondered. Honor the charge they made, honor the Light Brigade, noble 600. The Charge of the Light Brigade by Alfred Lord Tennyson, 1870. Here's a list of popular blunders. The Edsel, the Corvair, the Yugo, 2 out of 3 of the Little Pig's houses, 8 out of 10 doctors recommending old golds, the supersizing of everything, just as we tried to downsize our bodies, wardrobe failures, Bay of Pigs, Watergate, Geraldo Rivera doing nearly anything, the swine flu vaccine, George Bush Sr. and Japanese food, George Bush Jr. and pretzels, the hunt for weapons of mass destruction. When we make them as a nation, sometimes the results hang on like a bad cold. But whether public official or private citizen, you make them. Yeah, you do. Blunders are as plentiful as bad air. We misspeak ourselves, neglect to check, overlook the obvious, or just put two and two together wrong. Today, Mind's Eye writers confess themselves and others in Oops! Or the Tao of Do.
I'm a conversational blunderer.
Madison writer Guy Thorvaldsen.
A world champion linguistic yoga master, able to put both feet in my mouth and still remain standing. At the ready to toss yet another verbal faux pas into the mix. If there's an elephant in the room, I have an uncontrollable urge not only to mention it, but to want to climb on top and shout, "Look at me, I'm riding the elephant." What's scary about this is not so much unearthing someone's darkest secret, but it is that I perform these verbal blunders unconsciously. For example, my friend Angela comes back to work a couple days after her mother's death. While I'm aware of Angela's grieving, somehow in the course of the conversation, I blithely end up launching into some stupid story about how good the coffee break donuts are, and complain how my mother never baked one thing during our entire childhood, and how deprived I felt not ever having a birthday cake, and why didn't my mother bake? And suddenly, Angela's breaking down in tears, because of course her mom was the world's best baker. It's not like I'm in the break room at work thinking that no one is talking about the fact that Angela's mother just died. In fact, it's just the opposite. I seem not to think at all. My brain just seems to engage itself, willy-nilly, before I even have the option to censor it. What's even more curious about this propensity to stir the muck at the bottom of the sacred pond is that I'm actually a somewhat private person, guarded about what I say, generally careful about offending anyone. This guardedness was no doubt bred and fostered in my family of incessant teasers. Anything that came out of our mouths, be it a success or admission of failure, was fair game for humiliation. I know all too well the dire price of divulging sensitive information. But there I am, taking a walk with my good friend Scott, who has been recently divorced from his wife. We're out in the country and it's a nice day, so I start to happily whistle the tune to Bicycle Built for Two. An innocent song? Nope. It happens to be the very same song that he and his ex used during their wedding day, as they rode a tandem bike to the church. Suddenly, Scott goes silent, wants to cut the walk short and go back home. That's when I get it. Again, a totally unpremeditated act by me, except for the fact that I was at the wedding, and that my brain had obviously stored this emotional grade for just the right time. It seems that anything anyone wants to avoid, I will manage to interject it into the conversation. Just had a mastectomy? I'll manage to talk about how I just saw Dolly Parton in concert. Just lost your job? I'll natter on about how wonderful my boss is to have covered my health care for a year. Arrived at the party with your seeing eye dog? I'll go on and on about the latest movies I've seen, of course commenting on the cinematography. Now, of course, I realize that 50% of the population will listen to this and instantly lump me into being just another one in the crowd of insensitive men. But I think they're wrong. I am sensitive. In fact, I'm a pro at tuning right into a person's sore spots, a specially tuned antenna for the painful, the embarrassing, the humiliating. But that's where I get stuck. I seem to go into a kind of emotional overload. My empathetic sensibility goes in lockdown, and my unconscious brain kicks in, takes over my mouth, and out comes the stupid story about how I plan to retire in 5 years. And won't that be great? While Bill is contemplating what to do with his last breath. I'm like in an emotional toothpaste tube that's being squeezed without taking the top off. Eventually it will leak out the side. But in the end, perhaps the foot-in-the-mouth tendency isn't all that bad. I mean, it's still toothpaste, whether it comes out the side or the top. And what comes out of my mouth is, for better or worse, usually the truth. If you think about it, who hasn't suffered silently to themselves, mutely hoping someone will approach them and offer an opportunity to feel out loud? Sometimes we need a not-so-gentle nudge towards our emotional well, an incentive to let out the grief, a punching bag at which to fling our fury. And though I don't offer myself willingly as the punching bag, it seems, for better or worse, it is often my verbal blunders that open the door for positive change. This doesn't mean I'm always forgiven. In fact, my little poignant interludes have won me a fair amount of grief. But I have always been willing to apologize, and most of my good friends have stuck with me in the long run. But if I had a choice, I'd gladly give someone else the job of spotting the elephant. It's way too dangerous in that particular jungle. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
I made a big mistake, oops. I didn't calculate, I thought I'd be okay, and then, oops, I'm sorry. Oops, I made a big mistake, oops. I didn't calculate, I thought I'd be okay, and then, oops, I'm sorry. I thought I'd be okay, and then, oops, I'm sorry.
Roughing up a laptop is certainly startling in any circumstances, but writer Reno Catalani takes the idea of blunder upon blunder to its logical paranoid extreme in Tiny Terrorists Among Us.
I knew I shouldn't have done it. I knew it right away. But knowing better after doing bad does you no good, T-Dak. Please say nothing of it, not to Mrs. Bradley, our unit supervisor, and not a word to my baby. Angry minority male, my boss'll say, under her breath naturally, on account of it being not nice and illegal and all to say what we all know too well. Stupid brown boy, my baby'll hiss a second after she smacks her Camry's door on white folks' world. What on earth's wrong with you, though she knows doggone good what's wrong with me, about me, whole wheat in milk toast America? Fine, I'll tell you what I done, because we're from a cooler corner of our simmering Muslim world. Better hear it from me than our more militant cousins. But Ma'af, I implore you, not a whisper to Mr. Attorney General John T-Rex Ashcroft's hungry buds at their jazzed-up justice. Ayo, here goes. I slam my fist onto my laptop. My compact stuttered a second, she wheezed a whir, then gone. A dozen gigabytes up in smoke, I shut her lid gently. I slid my peepers left, I slid them right, worrying someone saw me. I beat it, quick as a bunny, into our 14th floor lav. I locked myself in a stall. There the trouble began. Out went the lights, black as death. Ordinarily, you wave your arms and that little wall switch eyeball lights you up again. I reached high, swayed side to side, YMCA disco style. Nothing. Furry night. I felt for my stall lock. I stepped out, and that toilet knew. It flushed hard, flushed loud like a galloping Komodo dragon gulping something nasty. I dashed for the door. I nipped for our elevators. Down I pressed. Nothing. Down I poked, hard. Down I jabbed 4, 6, 8 times, elevator 1 loafed at Standard Insurance Plaza's lobby, number 2 stayed at 15, number 3 passed me by, icing me, dropping straight to B2. Well, you can go straight to hell, I hissed between those thick black rubber lips sealing his smart aleck stainless steel doors, and I was going to punctuate it with a punch, but a puny voice made me look up. Look left, where a glassy black video eye and its blinking little red bro too look down at me. I can't recall them wiring our hall ceiling, but I figure they're protecting us from grumpy car crash claimants, unauthorized toilet users, and alike, for our own good, securing us from bad boys foreign and domestic. Including compact crushers like me, including that suddenly wild Lao guy those Milwaukee cops just had to blow away last summer, including that inexplicably mad Maya boy Beloit police had to shoot dead last year, including, of course, all those inextinguishably furious black men ducking law enforcement from one end of America to the other, then too. I beat it down our stairs. I hippity-hopped 14 pig-iron flights, enjoying their echo, my romp, my freedom from our floor's leering lenses. Again, tell no one, but I was having fun. Ayo, joy. Ground floor door open into Standard's lobby. An entry cam blinked angrily. I dashed mid-block across Fifth Ave and ducked into that place all us anxious Gretchen suddenly exposed in widely ambivalent America duck. Cinnabon, basement corner, Pioneer Mall. Cinnabon cures all. Mini-bon for little blues, volcano size for more serious situations. Cinnabon, I said. Naturally, smiled a bushy-browed, boo-boo-lipped Mexican girl, chocolate eyes. She looked at me at her, she at me. That's when I realized she needed more. Oh, right, a big one, por favor. Extra whipped cinna butter, manita, if you please. Latin ladies love good manners. Straight she went to work. Gently she laid my Cinnabon. Tenderly she folded his own little box, which she handed to me. I smiled at her, she at me at her. Oh, I realized she needed 269 for my roll. Right, I went for my wallet and peeked in. Momentito, I said apologetic, then zipped to the ATM. That machine sipped my card with a businesslike bizz-blip. Hello, Jimmy Kumbang, went its blue screen. Please enter your password. I did. He blip-blipped a bit more. He paused to consider me. I turned around, my sinner lady was still waiting, smiling. I turned to my machine. U.S. Bank was still thinking about it, about me. The little camera I screwed me into sharper focus. Those blippity blips became more grave. My money, my Cinnabon were becoming less likely. Meanwhile, Cinna Girl had gone to work on an Eddie Bauer white guy. I turned back to my machine. Its well-considered blips turned into determined tidzits, tidzits. Without further discussion, with an ugly gulp, that ATM swallowed my beloved card. Error message, V2/:trans term, it said. Tidzit, tidzit, it went with finality. Out, spit a little note. We know about the compact, it read. I beat it. This is Ronald Latang, Sayang Catalan, for Wine's Eye Radio.
As if nature's mistakes weren't bad enough, we humans have to sometimes get in on the act, resulting, as Esther Cameron notices, in some very unnatural acts.
My ship is at the harbor bar, and I'll be 6 months gone. What shall I bring you from old England, the land that once was home? Oh, bring me a pot of Jack by the hedge, which some call sauce alone. It adds a tang to salads green, it bears white flowers in spring. I'd feel amid these alien plants more joy in gardening. More joy in gardening. And when you've sailed away again and have been gone a while, I'll look upon that Jack by the hedge and think of you and smile, and think of you and smile. How may I know this Jack by the hedge, and what may be its mark? When not in bloom its leaves are low, and like a deep-notched heart, and like a deep-notched heart. The traveler stands on England's shore, he walks in a country lane, and there he sees some Jack by the hedge, which some call sauce alone, which some call sauce alone. He's dug it up by its long white root, and in a pot of clay He keeps it with him the voyage through. He waters it every day. He waters it every day. His wife is glad to have him back, and glad he's kept his pledge, and not forgot her sauce alone, her pot of Jack by the hedge, her pot of Jack by the hedge. She's taken it out of the earthen pot, and in her garden gay, she's planted it to bloom, but there, alas, it does not stay. Alas, it does not stay. Its many seeds are borne by wind, by the foot of beast and man, and the farmer does not smile to see that leaf upon his land, that leaf upon his land. For it carpets all the woods, its root puts a bane into the ground. Our native flowers melt away and are no longer found, and are no longer found. We do not call it Jack by the hedge, nor is sauce alone its name. And we do not know who brought it here, but we hold them much to blame. We hold them much to blame. We are glad of garlic in the stew and of mustard on the meat. But when garlic mustard perfumes a field, it is not declared a treat. It is not declared a treat. But man sets nature's will at naught, and nature mocks his pain. And if we could get back through Eden's gate, we'd only trash it again.
Feeling somewhat invaded, I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
Whoever that hapless person was who brought us the garlic mustard and the zebra mussel, neither meant to cause harm, we trust. Similarly, sometimes somebody just gets a little sloppy, a tad distracted, forgets to tighten that bolt, reattach that hose, and so it goes, according to Matt Felgus.
Finally, after weeks of eyeing it, I found some time to relax in my newly completed whirlpool tub in my newly renovated bathroom. The water flowed into the tub. Now, I'm not much for similes, but it really did look like ice or glass as it came out of the sleek faucet. I stared for a moment, then ran my fingers through the water just to interrupt momentarily the solid flow. I gathered up the day's newspaper that I hadn't had a chance to read. Can people actually read a page of newsprint in a hot whirlpool? I was going to find out. It seemed to take longer to fill than I thought it should, but what did I know? I stepped in and realized the water coming from the faucet, which had started out hot, was now cold. And, although the drain was closed, the water level was falling, not rising. Finally, didn't the instructions on the whirlpool motor say it wouldn't turn on when the water level was below the jets? I pressed the button that would turn off the motor. Strangely, nothing changed. Through the motor's buzz, I could hear what sounded like water rushing through a drain, but the drain was still closed. I leaped from the tub, wet only to my ankles, jumped into shorts, and ran downstairs. On the kitchen ceiling, I could see the bow from the weight of the water, and the kitchen fixture was filling. I turned it off. I continued on into my finished basement and saw it was raining. Part of the dumped contents of the whirlpool tub were showering through one of the recessed can lights onto the carpet, and the rest was pouring into my laundry room, on top of the new supersized hot water heater. I ran back upstairs. The motor continued to buzz, its whine growing higher pitched and angrier. There was no water left in the tub. Would the motor burn out? Start an electrical fire that would ignite the house? Back to the basement. The electrician had rewired the fuse box for the new addition. I threw the switch labeled Whirlpool. I ran up to the kitchen to listen for a silence that didn't come. Next went the switches for the bathroom, then the whole second floor. Clearly, the new directory did not correspond with the circuits it controlled. That, or the motor didn't care. Finally, I shut off the main switch. The motor was silenced, but I was standing in my basement, in darkness, and it was still raining. I threw on the main switch and ran back upstairs to the kitchen. I stopped dead. From the first floor, I could hear it, the roar of the monster motor. I grabbed the bucket, stuck it under the streaming basement light, and plunged my house into darkness once more. Time to call the contractor, on my cell phone, as the electricity-dependent cordless phones beeped around me. His wife was sympathetic, despite the hour, but couldn't change the fact that her husband was presently in California. There were two other partners of the company, the finance guy and the architect, and after numerous phone calls, I finally tracked down the architect, who agreed to come over. The least useful of the three, I decided, but at that point, I needed a witness and someone to tell me if the motor started growling as I restored the electricity. It was he who found the motor's plug under the sopping tub base and pulled it. The beast would sleep. He complimented me on keeping my calm and assured me that the damage would be repaired and everything would be okay. The plumber would come, as would the painter, and the drywall would be dried and repaired. Somebody would stop by in the morning to empty the water swilling in the kitchen light fixture. Good idea not to use it for the night, he said. They would have somebody pull up the basement rug and dry it, or replace it. Amazingly, we parted in calm. The hot water heater had shorted out, having taken much of the rain, but I didn't need hot water that night, nor soft water, as the water softener was beside it. Somebody would fix it. What else could I do? The plumber finally showed up later that week. A seal was loose. After the repair, he tested it, filled the tub, and started the monster motor. It purred, shut off when the water fell below the highest jet, would not be coaxed on, no, not until the tub was filled. Two dehumidifiers rumble in my basement. The light fixture in the kitchen was emptied of enough water to make waves. So I need to try the tub tonight, the contractor tells me. The four-day-old newspaper is still on the counter where I had set it. I need to relax tonight. It's been a busy week. Think I'll go out. Some truths are stranger than fiction, and this is Matt Felgus for Mind's Eye Radio.
We've heard of medical mishaps that didn't leave the guy a leg to stand on. The Darwin Awards, which are awarded to those poor schmucks among us who make such colossal blunders that they eliminate themselves from the gene pool, to the advantage of everyone else. Like the guy who tried to kill himself by hurling himself out of a 10th floor window, but was shot on his way down by his father, who was shooting at the mom who was standing in front of a window on the 9th floor. Now, that's a blunder. In the second half of the show today, Mind's Eye writers will regale you with tales of bloopers they've committed or witnessed or just plain imagined. Stay tuned for more of Oops or the Tao of Dull. Lynn Patrick Smith worries that he's cheated the Reaper one time too often in worrying about the next one.
It started with a string of accidents he walked away from, stuck a fork in the toaster, his hand in the snow blower, dropped his blow dryer in the bathtub, tumbled out of a second floor window, bounced safely off a canopy like it was a trampoline. It was then he started to believe in an allotment of accidents, and one more slip in the shower might be more than he's allowed. This is Lynn Patrick Smith, watching my step on Mind's Eye Radio.
We all groan at particularly horrifying medical blunders, usually imagining the victim's plight. But what, asks Kathy Miner, does it mean for a writer to make mistakes?
So I have this cartoon I've saved for 20 years, and it's about making mistakes. Sermonizing, heavens, yes, child, everyone makes mistakes. This is how we grow as human beings. And at the end, the little girl holding her report card says, wow, I'm going to be a great human being. And today I am thinking about mistakes, about how when you or I slip up in our work, it costs someone some time, some material, or some money. But when other people, like soldiers and surgeons, do, the price is measured life by life. You have to have a thicker skin and a firmer confidence than I will ever grow to choose a job like that. You have to know you will make very few mistakes, and that the ones you do make, the lives you forfeit, will be far fewer than the ones you save, the quick and right choices you see and pursue. I have a friend who fixes people's damaged hearts using his own deft hands and precision instruments, and he does it very well, dozens, even hundreds of people now owing their lives to his skill. I know this, and he does too. But he also knows all the ones who got away, who didn't follow his advice, to whom his advice was wrong or unconvincing, who couldn't drive here fast enough or wait long enough to be saved. These he ticks off on his fingers in a litany of regret and responsibility, even while he knows that their numbers are small. I have not nearly such courage. I'm grateful for errors written in ink and not in blood. I do not want to grow that much, become that great a human being. Holding tight to my eraser, this is Kathy Miner for Mind's Eye Radio.
Poet Norma Gay Pruitt knows that sticks and stones can break your bones, but maybe words can do some damage, too.
Here's an excerpt from E.A. Robinson's poem, Mr. Flood's Party. I took the title of my poem from this excerpt. Then, as a mother lays her sleeping child down tenderly, fearing it may awake, he set the jug down slowly at his feet, knowing that most things break. Knowing that most things break, you lick the flap of the envelope twice, softening the sentiment of the rejection inside. Knowing that a disgruntled postal worker somewhere may choose to open fire the very day your letter is pouched in the bag at his side, doubling the break. Knowing that most things break, you may drive the nail to hang your mother's mother's gilded plaster plaque of the old rugged cross one extra whack. You may soften the scolding you feel you must deliver when later your child lies about breaking it. Knowing that of all the things that break, words let loose in the trusting air can break, can break. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, having been both a breaker and a breakee for Mind's Eye Radio.
Thank you. Life is full of choices, but too often, out of blind stubbornness, we pick the wrong one, which seems to be the case with poor Harry in Paul Thompson's story, A Bad Choice. But then Harry really doesn't have much of a chance against a fantasy gone way off the map.
Harry was unbuttoning the swelling, white-starched bodice of his dream nurse's uniform when she said, "Listen, we've got to talk." "What do you mean?" Then it hit him. She had spoken spontaneously. "I mean, things have got to change." "How can you be talking? You're a fantasy." "Fantasies have feelings, too." He was so floored by the sheer impossibility of the situation that he couldn't reply. "I mean," she said, straightening up and buttoning her front, "I'm tired of the life you're forcing me to lead. This uniform, just for example, it's scratchy and uncomfortable, especially with no underwear. And nurses haven't worn uniforms like this for ages." Harry was recovered enough by now to challenge her. "Look, this is ridiculous. Let me say it again. You're a fantasy. You're not real." "That's just what I mean. I'm not real. Look at the dialogue you give me. Oh, baby, you're so big. Give it to me, baby." "Who talks like that?" "Look, I went to Bryn Mawr. I've read Finnegan's Wake." "Finnegan's Wake? I haven't read Finnegan's Wake." "Exactly." "What do you mean, exactly?" "I'm supposed to get all excited over somebody whose idea of a good read is Accounting Monthly, who's short and balding and doesn't even trim his nose hair?" "I don't have nose hair." "Correction. Someone who's short and balding and doesn't know he has nose hair." "There's no need to be insulting." Those lovely blue eyes softened, and she reached out and patted Harry's hand. "I'm sorry. You aren't so bad. If you could just see me for what I am, someone like you. Somebody who responds to tenderness and wants to be acknowledged for who they are, not just a projection of your infantile need to be babied."
But that's the whole idea. You're a projection."
"I bet you don't even know my name."
"Name? I don't need a name for you."
"It's Eleanor. Just say it, Harry. Eleanor."
"No, I'm not going to say it. You are a fantasy. You don't have a name. You never had a name. You never will have a name."
"Well, then, I guess we go on to Plan B."
"Plan B? What do you mean, Plan B?"
"The others and I have been talking, Harry."
"What others?"
"The tall, slinky one you dance the tango with in Montevideo. The cheerleader you grope in the back seat of that Volvo. The nanny that gives you the bath and does interesting things with the soap. And the spanking girl."
"The spanking girl? You've talked to the spanking girl?"
He found his face burning, as if his ex-wives had gotten together to compare notes. "Yes, and we all agree. Something has to be done. Call it an intervention."
"I don't need an intervention."
"We need an intervention, Harry. We're tired of not being treated with respect. Of being mere objects, Harry. Objects."
"But you are." Harry decided he had to be brutal. "I created you. I created you for just one purpose. That's it. The long and the short. That's all she wrote. Fini."
"It's not fini, Harry. You are now speaking to the steward, not stewardess, mind you, steward, of Local 1, Amalgamated Fantasy Workers of America, AFWA for short, and we have a list of demands."
"Oh, Corpus Christi, demands."
"First, comfortable on-the-job clothing. No starched uniforms, no spike heels, no drafty miniskirts, no leather bras."
"All no excitement."
"Second, a regular schedule. We're tired of being hauled into your fantasy at all hours. No notice, just show up and perform, even on Sundays. Some of us have kids, you know."
No, I didn't know. Third, just as I said, we want respect. We are not bimbos. We are not sluts. We are fantasy workers, proud of our contribution to the American psyche. And suppose I don't give in to your demands? Eleanor patted his hand again. Then we go on strike. Oh, Galveston Bay, on strike? How in the Alamo can you go on strike? Try us and see. Harry saw his choice, and he hated it. If he gave in, he just couldn't imagine what it would be like. Yes, he could. It would be like his marriages, women wanting the impossible from him. But if he didn't agree... But wait, these were his fantasies, right? This Eleanor, she had conned him into thinking they had some independent existence, but by all the rivers in Texas, they didn't. They were bluffing. Okay, listen, and listen good. Once and for all, you are my creation, and you are going to do what I tell you to do. Comprende? You will stop this nonsense right now, or I'll get rid of all of you and bring in new workers. I mean, dream girls. I'll kiss a goat before I give in to your so-called demands. Suddenly, they were all there. Eleanor in her nurse uniform, tall and slinky in a black low-cut sheath, the cheerleader with her big pom-poms, Nanny with the capable hands, and Spanking Girl, all of them looking at him with a mixture of scorn and pity. Then they were gone, leaving the goat. A billy goat, with a beard and a hostile expression. The goat looked at Harry. Harry looked at the goat. Well, he thought, put a skirt on it, and who knows? This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Remember the guy who couldn't even end it all gracefully? Evie Thompson goes him one better when the opportunities for blunders are multiplied by role reversals.
Everybody makes mistakes, Elaine said, her lips pursed, her eyes calculating. The gun shook slightly in Stephen's hand. It was pointed straight at her. Well, pretty straight. Yes, but not everybody has to hear about them each and every time. I meant me. I meant I made a mistake. Oh, a lot more than one. She nodded. Now was not the time to quibble. His face was working. There was sweat on his upper lip. She thought, I wonder where he got the gun. I hope he left the safety on. That would be so like him. Better not to push him, though. Look, she said, I'll never, ever restack the dishwasher after you've loaded it again. Too little, too late. His face twisted in a grin. All these years you've criticized me. I didn't get all the grime out when I scrubbed the sink. Your white T-shirts got grayed down because I threw those new black socks in the same washer load. Oh, I could go on and on. She could see he was working himself up even more. Was there a chance he hadn't loaded the gun, or that it was too old and would misfire? That might be too much to hope for. Better to try being humble. I've been thinking for a long time I needed to change. I was just waiting for my life to settle down a bit so I could do that. Settle down from what? You don't lift a finger around the house. Oh, yes, you go and buy groceries at the discount store every 3 weeks. But otherwise you just sit on your butt while I do all the work here. Well, I did get repairs done on both cars, and I took the lawnmower in for a tune-up. She could see he was getting angrier. Better leave that. Too argumentative. Look, Stephen, I do love you. If you really need this, I can change. I'll even go into therapy. The gun lowered slightly. No more criticisms? No more criticisms. And you're going into therapy? Yes, I'll go into therapy. Nah, that's too easy. The gun came up again. For all those times you belittled me. For all those nasty comments. The whites were showing around his eyes. Oh, my God, she thought, he's really going to do it. The room turned white before her eyes, and she began to fall off the chair. He pulled the trigger. Nothing happened. He turned the gun barrel toward himself and began to look down into it. Then he looked at her and grinned lopsidedly. "Nah, don't get your hopes up. I'm not that stupid." He turned the gun toward the ceiling and fired. As the blast echoed, a look of mad triumph spread across his face. But now rattling, grating sounds came from the chain of the antique chandelier overhead, which broke loose and in a shower of plaster and broken glass crashed down on Stephen, knocking him to the floor. "Stephen!" Elaine cried, and rushed over to him. She dragged the frame off him. "Mother's Tiffany!" he groaned. "Mother's Tiffany!" The gun had fallen from his hand. Stephen raised himself to a crouch and rocked back and forth in the midst of the glittering shards of glass. Elaine squatted down and, putting her arms around him, drew him to her. "It's okay, Stephen. It's okay. Everybody makes mistakes." This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio. Ding 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 ding
Most of us have heard about the unbelievably real guy who attached several large balloons to his Kmart web-seated aluminum lawn chair, grabbed his trusty BB gun, and floated away into the sky blue yonder. How he got down is another story. John Morgan imagines a similar fate for a character named McGarrity.
McGarrity's Odyssey. Up in the sky in a hot air balloon, the winds on high were fair, but all too soon a seam split, and my balloon was burst, depositing me on the roof of the First National Bank of Chicago. Although I survived, when the helicopter with the cops arrived, they said, "What are you doing up here on the roof?" I said, "Well, officer, to tell you the truth, as a matter of fact, I fell from the sky." "Aha," said the cops, "we've got a wise guy." They took me down and tossed me in a cell. The minimalist decor I thought was swell. "So, wise guy, did you land with a parachute to slip through a vent to nab some loot that hadn't been lent? Wasn't that what you planned?" "Oh, no, that wasn't where I planned to land. There is nothing but the force of fate to blame. Perhaps there was too much fire in my flame. Anyway, your argument is sliced. I did not set me there to make a heist." The cop's contempt was such they could not mask it. "Then what's the hell with this great big basket? Didn't you intend to fill it up full of cash, then jump off in it to have yourself a bash?" Well, now I was in a pretty pinch. The cops, they would not give me half an inch. I could see they were smarter far than I, for dreaming up a scheme that I would never try. To crown their calculations with success, to the caper I was happy to confess. Although I was looking out for loot, they said I was too dumb to prosecute. So, as my penalty, with no defense, $50 for lack of common sense. Now, when I am up in my balloon, it seems that the moon's a big doubloon. This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
Many of us wander through life with a vague notion of a goal, then seem to go out of our way to avoid the proper outcome as it looms near. Oscar Morales made a running start at academia and then stopped, started, stopped, and finally sort of blundered to success. For your information, Oscar thought the topic for this show was blinders and wrote a poem about it, but wouldn't read it. That makes blunder number what for Oscar? Well, he'll tell you about it.
It took me 19 years to finish my college degree. No, I wasn't smart enough to go to school that long. It was just the fact that between the time I started college and getting my BS diploma, 19 years got in the way. I used to blame this blunder on my social research professor, who did not like me or understood why I was dating three women in the class. He also didn't like that I would sit in the last row on the right side of class, turn my chair to the right 90 degrees so I could see him and my classmates at the same time. He also didn't appreciate me sleeping with the sociology department secretary, who was 39 years old at the time when I was 22. And worse, I think he liked her too. So in May 1977, when I got behind in class and needed a couple of weeks' extension to finish my report, he said, "No, I don't think I'll be able to offer you that option at this time." And I said, "F you." 2 years later, my blunder resurfaced when I was offered a fellowship to get a master's degree in bilingual education on a project I was already working on. The university was going to let me start without finishing my bachelor's degree, just roll it in with the coursework. But I turned it down, told them I had a job I liked, and forgot to mention that the job was ending in a few months. I didn't think about finishing my blunder again until 1983, when my girlfriend Tess suggested going back to finish my degree, and the relationship ended before I had a chance to do anything. When I got married in 1986, it seemed like the right time to settle things with this blunder. It had already been 10 years, and when the council reviewed the graduation requirements, I needed a couple more sociology credits to finish my major, retake the social research class, take a math class, and have 15 of the last 30 credits be from the same university before I could graduate. I went 2 nights a week, driving 2 hours to school, spent the Tuesday and Thursday nights in a $20 a night dorm room, and had 3 classes, 2 of which met at the same time, but the professor gave me life credit for 1 class, and I traveled enough to pass the other 2. But I was still short a couple of classes. They didn't offer the social research class till next semester, and no night math classes, so things got delayed again. In 1989, I tried a self-paced social research class out of the University of Tennessee. After paying $500 for tuition, another $150 for books and paperwork, I almost got to the end of the first chapter and gave up because it seemed too much for 1 class, 1 blunder, and realized I was still mad at that professor and quit. In 1994, I was about to be offered the job of director of Omega School, and when the board president asked to see my transcripts, "I have 118 credits, I stammered, no degree and 1 blunder. What does that mean? I'll get back to you." And sure enough, a half hour later, she said, "We will hire you, but you have to finish your degree within 2 years. In 1995, I made another stab at the mathematics class. I was out of town the first week and got my books late. And by the time I made the first class, the end of the second week, the Russian-speaking teaching assistant said there was no way I could pass the class because I had already missed an exam and 2 quizzes, and even if I aced the rest of the course, I was too far behind. I took a social research class, and waiting outside of class in the hallway the first day, 3 students asked me if I could give them the course syllabus before they had to run off. And I explained to the first one that I hadn't received one yet, and it didn't occur to me until the 3rd one asked that they had mistaken me for the professor. And the professor was a little intimidated by my age and experience and agreed to leave me alone as long as I did the same for him and gave me a B as long as I showed up for class and not showed him up. So I finally enrolled in an Algebra 2 class at the community college, and the class was full of eager 19-year-olds, and before we got past 2 weeks, half the class was gone, and I ended up doing a couple of hours of homework each night. Even though I had had trigonometry and advanced math in high school, this was a lot more work than I needed, but I did it, and sent in the transcripts and got my degree, and realized that many people were in the same boat within a semester of graduating college, but there was so much emotion and conflicts that they might as well have had enough credits to be a freshman, because that is as far as it seemed. But this experience, this blunder, has helped me in my job working with high school dropouts. I know what it is like to not finish, and learning that failure is comfortable for some people, and that finishing your college degree does lift a big weight off your shoulders. and my greatest blunder has turned out to be the greatest lesson I could have ever learned. This is Oscar Morales.
So have you lived to regret that slip of the tongue that still causes you to blush, even in memory? Most of us have, but we cover our gaffes with words like misspeaking ourselves or encountering a negative outcome. A blunder on the part of the pilot becomes an unexpected interface between craft and ground. When someone is killed by his own army, we say he died of friendly fire. When the U.S. bombed the Chinese embassy, it was not really a blunder, but rather a targeting miscalculation. Othello blundered in believing Iago, and we all know the outcome there. Perhaps to blunder is human, and to rephrase divine. Who knows? And that's our show. You've been listening to Oops, or The Tao of Dull, written by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson Zielski. Today's writers today. Oh! Today's writers include Esther Cameron, Matt Felgus, Kathy Miner, Oscar Morales, John Morgan, Renaud Catalani, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rall, Lynn Patrick Smith, Evie Thompson, Paul Thompson, and Guy Thurvolts. Original music by Barbara Chusid. For a copy or more information about Mind's Eye Radio, go to www.mindseyeaudio.com. We are now downloadable at Radio for All. That's 4, like the number 4, Radio for All at www.radioforall.net. I'm Greg Willard. Until next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.